everybody. Welcome to the latest in the ongoing musical journey that is today New Brunswick, tomorrow the world. I kind of just ride the Bog Monster music hashtag, you know, but we all kind of got our own thing. Joined with me here as ever is the inestimable Dan Hayward. Dan, how are things?
Not too bad. How are things going with you, Matt?
None too shabby. I was just, before we started to hit the record button here, by way of an opening gambit, I was sort of trying to just see if I could see if Dan might, you know, or any of you hypothetical people playing along at home were to guess the virtual background, those of you who are watching the video, which is historically much less of you than listen on the Spotify and such. However, let me assure you, in this virtual background, there is a significant reference to one of my picks for Dan. What are we even talking about? It's concept albums, is it?
Yeah, Dan? It was. I said, let's talk about some cool concept albums or some of our favorite concept albums.
But right on.
It was kind of a way. This, of course, it was a way of me backdooring, a way of just, there was, I was listening to something and I was trying to figure out a way to work it into the show. And other than just, oh, what are you listening to? And I was like, well, this is definitely, I think it's a concept album. And then I realized there were a couple other favorites. It was an excuse to talk about a couple other things that I, you know, want to talk about on the show at some point as well anyway. So, but yeah, just. In particular, there were one or two that was like, huh, you know, and it's just a particular kind of record that not everybody can pull off, but, you know, can be kind of interesting, you know, can be an interesting way of like exploring a topic or an idea.
Man, first of all, I was really pleased when you sort of put this forward in the first place, because like some of the times I feel like I got to kind of scramble to be like what the comedy albums want. I was like, man, I sat on that for 2 months before I could really articulate that, which is fine, you know, but like, yeah. For so-called quasi-academic person or whatever. So for this, I'm just like, okay, we got a burgeoning list. And I actually even just now was like able to prioritize them a bit here, just in, so I can just sort of, if I don't speak to all of them, there's always the notes. But an interesting thing with this particular topic, Dan, is Dan's the director, so he picks the topic and he sets the pace. We actually had this one slotted out before your excursion into God. I don't even want to mangle the genre that you spoke to.
The reason why I've been just getting really weird recommended ads on YouTube lately. But yeah, my explorations into just like certain subgenres of Mexican, I guess what they call like Mexican regional music, is like the broad term that's going around. That's AKA Dan learns about a new thing. But this was one I kind of like sketched out beforehand and ended up like switching up my list a bit over the course of time since then. Cause that, you know, give me enough time and I will have like three or four different ideas and then forget half of them anyway. But, you know, like I said, it's the concept album is, like I said, it's a medium not everybody can really pull off, but you know, you get some interesting stuff out of sometimes.
Totally dope. I'm super curious as to what your first one is, dude.
Well, I might as well go with the one that was my excuse to try and the thing I was trying to shoehorn into the show, which is an album in a genre that I really am not that familiar with. It's like I've been adjacent to and around and generally can appreciate some of the time, but it's, you know, not always for me. And that's black metal. Specifically.
Oh my God. But is your first a black metal record? I am not worthy to be on this podcast.
Here's the thing, though. It is a black metal bluegrass fusion album. There's also a concept album about labor struggles in the coal mining industry in Kentucky, which is the band Panopticon's 2000 album, Kentucky, which it's like I said, black metal, it's one of those genres that like I've kind of just like watched happen from afar because it gets covered in a certain kind of like, you know, kind of like it has some characters, shall we say. I have a coworker that's super into it. Who just actually flew to Norway for the weekend from Ottawa to see the 40th anniversary performance of the surviving members of the band Mayhem, which
don't
if you know their whole
like
story,
kill each other with
one of them did. I think one of them was killed, and one of them killed themselves. Another one was killed by someone who went to jail for a while and is now, you know. Okay. On Twitter every once in a while. The murder, anyways, it's a whole thing. But you see, in the mid, I feel like the late aughts to 2000 teens, there was like an American offshoot of black metal that tried to like take, I guess, I don't know if you, a bit of a turn from that side of the genre. Like, you get a lot of bands like Wolves in the Throne Room from Oregon, who were like, they mixed a lot of like shoegaze and almost kind of like post rock, like Godspeed You Black Emperor kind of moments into their music, while also having like, you know, more decidedly like leftward political slant than a lot of folks in the genre, shall we say. And Panopticon, they started out as this guy Austin Lund's solo recording project where he played all the instruments. He did a series of demos that a lot of which were sort of had songs written around a particular theme. Like one of the album songs was all about like just experiences dealing with like, I guess like social services and trying to like access that. And like, what, you know, like an album around like mistreatment of indigenous people in his state. And then in 2012, he did this album Kentucky, where it's like, you know, like one of the tropes of black metal is mixing like kind of folk elements, but because a lot of it's from places like Norway and that where it's, you know, sort of European, these like European folk stylings and like Viking drinking ballads or whatever fucking bullshit. But Austin Lund took, you know, the traditional music of Appalachia where he grew up and mixed like bluegrass. So you'll get this like frantic like melodic blast beat part with like an ocarina solo over top of it that then kind of like slowly drifts off into like a really nice banjo part, and then like just like a straight up cover of Which Side Are You On, like the old Union song, and then like all these sound bites of like, you know, from, it's like, you know, if you decided to make a musical version of Harlan County, USA, but yeah, had blast beats and corpse paint. Which, you know, like when you're working in the mines, you get covered in, you know, a lot of gross black dust anyway that could look like black metal makeup, who knows. But yeah, I just thought it was like a really cool idea. Sorry,
I was just gonna ask, so sort of facetiously, so does that black metal machine kill fascists?
I would say it does. It's definitely geared to, It's definitely geared
it's
in that
like
direction.
Guthrie, like...
Exactly. Well, it's like it's taking like Woody Guthrie and like the old Joe Hill Union songs, like that kind of thing, like mixing that with black metal. It's not Mermaid Avenue Part 4 or anything, but like, you know, it's just like I said, a really cool mix of genres and like a real, I thought it was a really cool idea. That like, you know, for someone, because it's like I want to like, it's somebody, it's, there's a lot of like heavier, more extreme music that I want to like, but I just can't, you know, I don't know, I just can't get with it sometimes. Yeah, it just, it's not my vibe, shall we say. And this was just, I thought it was like it's like very well played, like the more kind of like traditional bluegrass parts of the music are all like incredibly well played.
Describing actually sounds really cool, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's all the fact that it's all one guy, like on this album. Like eventually, like he didn't expand the project to a full band for another 3 or 4 years. Like they're still going. They put out an album last year. I think they've got 4 or 5 albums out now. They're not as heavy on the bluegrass elements these days, but like Yeah, just to sort of detour that way for an album, like to take that like black metal mixed with folk elements concept, but to take it to the hills of Kentucky, and
Kentucky is fundamentally weird. I mean, one of the, it's funny that we're talking about Kentucky now, simply, because one of the things that happened, obviously, in the past, whatever time since we recorded the last show, is the passing of Steve Albini.
Which also is going to come up later on my list.
You start talking Kentucky, I start thinking Slint. And actually, I shit you not, at the very, very ass bottom of my kind of weird list that the maybe it's not quite a concept album, but I'm going to throw it in anyway. That's like my bottom ass. I'm going to call Spiderland a concept album just on fucking general principle. My last paragraph. Just a thing about Steve Albini being a fucking genius, rad, generational dude. It's like, it happened. And then I had the opportunity to just be like, okay, podcast notes for the friggin', music thing. Then three friggin' education podcast notes about it. And now, whatever. It's just, so fucking Slint. I love Slint so much. And Kentucky makes me think of Slint. So sorry to sort of hijack your thing.
No, that's okay. The B-side of Spiderland is like one of my favorite arcs of three songs leading into each other of like
anime. I don't really think of it as being a concept album, but I'm like, it's close enough. Like, it's just such an intense thing from start to execution, where it's just like, but it's also like, on the one hand, it's just this super serious, dark, fucking brooding, weird, like odd fucking time signature kind of music, but then it's just being executed by like these complete nerds. It's like, man, it's either like you're either wanting to slit your own windpipes or you're getting the biggest fucking joke out of it in the world. And maybe it's both. It could be both. It's really like, that's how, like, I don't even, for a band that only even recorded, they did that. They did Tweeze. Those are like the only two full lengths. They got this weird 10-inch that doesn't have any friggin' indications of musical names or whatever the crap, anything to indicate musicality except the music on the record. You could almost just as easily say, Tweeze, they named out every single song on like the record is named after one of their parents, for instance. The Google or the YouTube, the Apple Music algorithm piped me like, Carol, that's on the second side of Tweeze. I fucking love this one because it's got this really like menacing friggin', and it's like it's named after, the drummer's mom. Like, okay, whatever, dudes, I'm out. Like, so, and they all went on to way cooler things, but still, the fact that people are still interested in Slint, I cannot think of Kentucky without thinking of Slint, and I cannot think of Slint without thinking of Steve Albini. So, there we go, man.
All right.
Yeah, man. What's your?
I might as well free assist. The next one, the next thing I was going to mention was one that I was maybe just going to throw in as an honorable mention, but might as well put in here now since you've mentioned a character in sort of the greater arc of it, which is the Satanic Versus EP by the band Mile Marker, are you familiar with Mile Marker?
Yeah,
they're a band that I feel like they're like at a lot of interesting cross sections of things, because like, they definitely come from like a very scrappy punk rock end of the world. Like Al Berrien's old band Hellbender were like very much like sort of, you know, sort of Jawbreaker-ish, like, you know, one of those bands that sort of came in the wake of, like, your Jawbreakers and your Sam I Ams back in the day. Their bassist played a lot of bar chords, if you know what I mean. And then, yeah, like, he sort of moved to North... ended up sort of moving to a couple more college towns and going more of, like, a post-hardcore direction with Mile Marker. And they're very always cool. Really kind of, like, high... The very... I was trying to think of a way to describe them, and I guess clever is a way I would describe a lot of what they do, just in terms of, like, you know, like, they had their Frigid Form Cell, like, was their whole album about, like, advertising. And it was basically, like, Adbusters, the, you know, Adbusters, the Scrams record.
I love that record so much.
It's so good. Yeah. And they were one of the first punk bands I remember making a song entirely out of samples of other punk bands. They had a song called The Human Factor on one of their early records. That I remember first getting really excited about it because I was like, hey, it's the guy from Hellbender who does that zine I like. Because, Albarian from Mile Marker actually did a really great zine called Burn Collector over the years that's been published. There's a couple, like, you can get a couple, like, book-type anthologies.
I've heard of that.
In the world. Yeah, it's... Anyways, I was a big fan of this guy's work in general. And, yeah, it's... And then hearing this song that's built primarily around, like, the drum intro but from Visible Distance by Universal Order of Armageddon, that, like, it's like that looped with them singing over it. And I was like, oh my God, these people, like, this is my shit. And, you know, they were always, you know, one of their common topics was, like, the encroachment of the digital into human life and the alienation thereof and postmodernism, etc. And
the paint a bit, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like they're somehow they come from, like, you know, it's like they're these kind of scrappy punk dudes coming from, like, more of, like, you know, starting in more of, like, kind of like the Shotmaker-ish type, like, emo post-hardcore type direction, but definitely have, you know, they're a band with that had a keyboard player at a time when, I guess, what they call the indie sleaze, like the Faint and, like, you know, like the Rapture and those kind of bands, like, when they were all, because a lot of those, like, a lot of those bands came. Yeah, like, the Faint were great, and, like, yeah. Like,
most they of those were definitely... songs, but I love the Faint. That's
yeah. Like, and, like, they had a split with the Blood... Like, Mile Marker had a split with the Blood Brothers as well back in the day. But, like, anyways, the Satanic Verses record, they decided they'd explore those themes a little more fully by doing three songs with totally analog equipment, tube amps, like... analog synths and, like, electric pianos for the keyboard player, and recorded to Steve Albini. And then the other three songs were more sort of in that, like, the Faintish type direction and done entirely using, like, synthesizers and, like, sequenced on a computer when that was still a fairly new thing for, like, especially for underground bands to do. And it was, you know, they called it Satanic Verses. And that was their little way of, like, you know, ooh, sort of the digital and the, you know, sort of the more warm and analog. And, I just thought that was one I was going to almost maybe even just save for an honorable mention. But since Steve Albini factored in there and he passed recently and just he's been on everybody's minds and everybody's been, you know, between, like, his music and just, like, some of his really fucking funny tweets, you know, like, and just amazing writing. The guy went to school for journalism. Like, he was a very talented and well thought out writer, even if, you know, he maybe wrote about some shit that he definitely thought about later on, you know, rethought later on, shall we say. But the fact that he actually did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, like, it's, I mean, there, like, between him and, like, the last surviving member of the MC5 just passed away the other day. And, like, you know, like, this has been a couple of those, like, you know, passings of significance of certain eras. And, just the fact that, Steve Albini sort of had a little hand in this, I figured I had to at least throw it on the main list. So, Mile Marker, Satanic Verses.
That is sick. I'm really going to have to check that out because I love a lot of the associated bands and Mama Marker themselves. That one record, I mean, that's the only one of theirs that I know. But
if you get a chance, well, you should try. I was going to say you should try and get some of the collections of Burn Collector if you ever get a chance as well. I know Trouble Man Records, their brief attempt at a print division was mostly to put out at least one of those anthologies. But yeah, really? Anyways. Yeah.
If I ever just somehow like end up like just ass first into like more money than like what me and my kids need necessarily, that'd be the kind of thing where I'm just like, I am a middle-aged man with, you know, like $10,000 to, you know, revive some whatever, do a just invest in the indie arts somehow, like just, you know, I'm going to be a magnate of sorts. And try, yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people try that and fail and lose money, but anyways, dude, that sounds all awesome and legit, and I am stoked to personally check that one out. If there's a couple here on my list that if I actually let this episode on Concept Records pass without mentioning them, I'm going to feel like I've done a disservice to the format. So I'm just going to say at the very, very top of my list is my favorite concept album of all time. It's not the one that's referenced in my background. I'll be speaking to that later. But my favorite concept album ever is Liz Phair, Exile in Guyville.
Nice.
Oh, my God. I'm just like, I don't pretend even not to be in love with Liz Phair. Her and PJ Harvey. It's just like, I am a middle
aged. Another great artist recorded by Steve Albini.
Yes, right. And Liz Phair from Chicago, right? The Midwest is just, you know, if you look at punk, if you look at comedy, if you look at like any kind of thing, I mean, speaking of Steve Albini, his partner, I think he's married. He has a wedding ring in most of his pictures, a band.
Yeah, I believe they were married.
He's a comedian with Second City, right? She's involved with it. I don't know what her role is, but do you know about that, Dan?
Yeah, I know that I knew she was a comedian with Second City, and there's like their big annual like Christmas charity fundraiser is one that was largely driven by Steve Albini and his wife.
Really?
Yeah, like I can't remember what they referred to it as, but yeah, like there's this big annual Christmas event. Like it was part of like I can't remember if it was the eulogy that came out in the past. Like so many things about Albini that came out in the past.
The thing is, I mean, again, like, I mean, just between us and anybody else who may care, or I mean, it's to state the obvious, but with that dude, I mean, you know, if it was just, you know, the shitty remarks that he made in his early 20s, you could say, well, you know, fuck that guy. But he just had such a significant output in so many formats. And, you know, he got to live to be an age where he completely recanted on his previous bullshit and didn't try and give it any kind of po-faced excuses or anything, it seemed. I mean, I read a few of those, you know, interviews. And the very fucking last thing he tweeted was like something to the effect of,
oh yeah, like, the Rolling Stones butthole or something like that.
It's a butthole.
Yes.
Like he tweeted that the day that he died, right? It's like, man. So, but like, but plus the community building. That's what I'm really getting at here. So now, completely, because we have to talk about Steve Albini apparently today of all days. But Chicago, crazy ass city for awesome music, any kind of art, whatever. All roads seem to lead to Chicago. And I mean, for me, my favorite concept album of all time, I mean, I don't even know. It's like they kind of like, yeah, okay, it's like a direct song by song response to, you know, Exile on Main Street. I don't see it. I'm familiar enough with Exile on Main Street because that's probably my favorite Stones record, pound for pound, I suppose. I'm not like the hugest Stones fan, but I really, really dig Exile on Main Street. But I'll tell you what, I like Exxon Guide a hell of a lot more for what it does, what it achieves. Like, wow. I mean, you just want to talk about like a powerful, independent young woman with swagger, just totally like, I don't give a fuck. I came here to rock, and I got my two friends here who are dudes, and they're just going to kick in, and we're going to play, you know, these songs that I wrote in my goddamn bedroom as an art student, and fuck all you nihilistic punk-ass Steve Albini wannabes out there. I mean, she just had such high self-awareness, high self-regard, and, I mean, concept album or not. I mean, it's just like there's just such a self-awareness of herself as a young woman out there, you know, in a field or whatever, an endeavor that's just, you know, where people like her are just treated as an afterthought or, you know, not even considered at all. And she's fucking kicking their asses at their own game. And it's just the document of that coming to fruition. And she's persisted with many quality releases, none of which I'm familiar with anywhere near as much as that particular record. She got the book outs. She actually wrote a memoir, Horror Stories. I read the first few pages, and it was kind of, it's intense. It's an intense read. She's an intense person. She's an intense, viable, powerful artist. And I just, you know, get weak in the knees. Ridiculous. I was like, I'm going to just find a picture of her for the thing, you know, the WordPress. And I'm like, focus, you idiot. Anyway, I love that record. So what's your next pick, dude?
My next pick is, well, it's an excuse to talk about one of my favorite bands and a topic that I'll always talk about. And that is the Mountain Goats 2015 album, Beat the Champ. I don't know how familiar you are with the Mountain Goats. They're one of those, I mean, they're just like, I think I've personally been familiar with their music for probably, I think it was probably like 2001, 2002 when I first heard their music, and they'd already been going for a decade at that point. And, you know, have since, I think I was looking up that, they've got 22 full length albums out at this point, dating back to the early 90s. All, you know, they're one of these bands that came out of like the whole like lo-fi home recording, like the, you know, the same, like same, we're recording this on a four track or cassette. Pardon?
Sorry, I was like, I'm sure I raised my hand and get your attention. I'm like, yo, I was just like, yo, dude, so first of all, that sounds rad. That sounds like Sebada and kind of whatever. Shit.
Yeah, like that same kind of that same era. Like,
is it the same lineup of musicians, or is it just like one person?
Well, it's been John Darnielle has been the central figure in the band the entire time. He's been the main guy, though for the past probably a little over 20 years since they, probably I think like 2002, the Sunset Tree album is when they kind of. They put together like their pretty standard lineup that also includes John Worster of Superchunk and Bob Mould's band and, you know, Sharpling and Worster comedy stuff and various other projects on drums. And I can't remember. I think he said the same bass player pretty much the whole time and occasional other musicians.
Cool.
And yeah, that's John awesome. Darnielle is just, he's a guy that's lived a pretty intense life. You know, up to the point of making music, like a lot of the song, like the Sunset Tree, that was like one of their bigger breakout albums, like in the early aughts. Like, it talks about some like pretty intense subject matter that comes from like having like a pretty rough childhood and that sort of thing. But like, just like these incredibly well written, like tense indie rock kind of. I don't know. It's like indie rock kind of cheapens it, but just like, you know, modern singer-songwriter, I guess you could say. And he's got like awesome. Some like this, you know, not like vibrato, but sort of like higher register voice, just very intense and passionate. And yeah, Beat the Champ was his album that he wrote about pro wrestling in 2015. That because as he'd mentioned, you know, as he sort of like tells part, you know, partially through songs on the album and through interviews about it, that like, you know, when he, after like he had sort of moved on from the part of his life that like a lot of songs on like some of their, you know, some of their more intense songs were drawn from, he had a stepdad that would take him to go see wrestling shows. Nice. And it was like the era, like the 80s, when like the territories era of wrestling was still around in the 80s before it became like the Vince McMahon monoculture for so long. And a lot of it, you know, he specifically references the Southwest territory, which like, I don't know if you're familiar with the recent film, The Iron Claw, that came out late last year.
I know what it is. Trailer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's that same, like watching, you know, he specifically references watching like, you know, a lot of that same circle of guys, you know, and on some of like the songs that reference specific events, like the big breakout single, or, you know, the lead single from the album is a song, The Ballad of Chavo Guerrero. He talks about, you know, sort of his favorite, this one guy who was his favorite wrestler to watch when he was younger, who, you know, was part of this dynasty of like, you know, had a family, you know, a family like Haven, all his other brothers were popular wrestlers in Mexico that were also working in the States. And, you know, he uses like the idea of wrestling and the stories it tells as a way to talk about like, you know, sort of like, just struggling against the darkness sometimes, I guess you could say, and like making it through life. And also like what it, like he even uses, I think the line was like, you know, I needed justice in my life and I found some, you know, talking about, you know, going to see these, you know, watch these stories play out at these events that he would, you know, him and his stepdad would go to watching these, like, you know,
the human drama
being told inside and outside the ring by these like grizzled road dog kind of like 80s territory wrestlers. And like,
that's
some
awesome.
Of the songs are like specifically, they're like, you know, he's using sort of like lingo and you know, just ideas from wrestling. Some are more directly, you know, talking about specific like the song called The Ballad of Bull Ramos is just like, I hope one day I get old, and the theme is basically like, I hope one day I get old and even if my body's falling apart, I'm still happy. And describing, you know, this old guy that he used to watch, you know, back in the day, and what he knew of his life later on, and how, you know, he'd had all these health health issues and that sort of thing, but, you know, lived a pretty happy life. Exactly. And yeah, he even had a song that strongly references the death of Bruiser Brody, who I'm actually wearing a Bruiser Brody t-shirt right now, who is the American wrestler stabbed to death in San Juan, Puerto Rico in the showers at a show he was booked on, where there were people in the other room, but no one was arrested. That has been fodder for...
That's crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of like true crime content about the whole thing. I think one of the first episodes of the show Dark Side of the Ring, which is like a sort of pro wrestling true crime series done by a guy from Halifax, actually, on the Vice Channel. One of their first episodes.
Are you serious?
Yeah, actually, they just finished season five.
Everything was shut down. Apparently not. Okay.
Well, it's this. I don't know what they're doing. Where, like, I don't know if the next season is going to be like.
Okay.
I think
but the thing is out now.
Yeah, but anyways, okay. they did, and it's on. It's all on Crave TV in Canada if you have access to that. But anyways, yeah. Like I said, one of the songs on the album, also about the death of Bruiser Brody, it's called Stabbed to Death Outside San Juan, Puerto Rico, which is, that's what happened to him. And yeah, it's just also, you know, an album of really great kind of like, you know, mostly acoustic, just singer-songwriter indie rock songs from, you know, coming from that kind of like just really heartfelt lo-fi tradition, but you know, they can do real studio time, and you know, they're all popular on NPR and stuff now. And I don't know, Rian Johnson, the filmmaker who, besides making a Star Wars movie people didn't like, made some really good movies like Brick. He had a TV series. He recently made a TV series called Poker Face that was kind of like an homage to your classic Columbos and whatnot. And, but starring Natasha Lyonne as the detective. And they had an episode about an aughts, like, alt metal type band that was a one hit wonder. Some crime sort of relating to the band and one of their fans. And John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats played one of the members of this like old new metal band and wrote the metal songs for the show. And I think co-wrote them with a guy from Hatebreed. I feel like they've hit that, like, you know, they're like the musical version of like a John Hodgman. If you know what I mean. Like, that's kind of the lane I feel like they occupy. Like, you know, if you could put like crossbreed, like the Hold Steady and John Hodgman, that would be the Mountain Goats. Their album Beat the Champ is, like I said, a concept album entirely about wrestling, pro wrestling. But they've done a few concept albums since before and afterwards, or albums that are like, he used a lot of reoccurring characters and songs over the years. Like, there's the Alpha Couple that pop up in a bunch of songs, and his most recent album was an entire album about this character Jenny that shows up in a bunch of their songs, in albums in like, yeah, some of the like 90s and aughts albums. It's like that, yeah, that deep in the lore, I guess you could say. But yeah,
its own metaverse, as it were.
Exactly. Sort of. There's a lot to it. But like I said, he's got 22 full length albums on top of a ton of different EPs and stuff. So there's a lot of Mountain Goats out there. But yeah, Beat the Champ specifically, his concept album about wrestling, was the one I wanted to add here.
Cool beans.
All right.
Again, there's an artist with such a vast and significant discography, it's cool when you can establish through lines. And just like as you were sort of describing that now, like I just was like, oh man, because that's just literally, I'm not going to use a pick on this because but it made me think like of the recurring characters and stuff such as you described. Man, that's totally what Craig Finn does with the Hold Steady.
Oh yeah. It's this, yeah.
And I love the Hold Steady. I even have Hold Steady like tattoo. Like that's, I got such regard for Craig Finn as like a modern American punk kind of, you know, like Springsteen, but for real losers, you know, like people who like are just too smart and too drunk for their own good most of the time to achieve very good. That's kind of my whole, I just love that whole genre of art, however it may come across. So what you were describing, I'm like, Separation Sunday is a friggin' concept album by the Hold Steady that I friggin' love. But that's not my real pick. The real pick, because I could sort of tie it to a similar time. Behind me, I, folks who can watch the video, if you're not, I'll just describe it to you. I am broadcasting not from St. John, New Brunswick in this case, but from Ashtray Rock, Nova Scotia. This is an Ashtray Rock structure created by AI. And that's just because I love Joel Plaskett, Emergency. I do so unapologetically and completely, like, I don't, it's funny because, like, I don't care about Thrush Hermit. Like, I don't even, like, I couldn't even name, like, I'm sure some of it's even, like, really good. Like, Clayton Park, I think, is probably a solid album from them. But, like, it's funny, just with Joel, I don't know. When Down at the Khyber came out, it was like when I was living in Halifax myself for the first time out of Fredericton, living somewhere else. And he's only, like, 3 years older than me. So it's like I see his whole, like, you know, unfolding a bit, just a few years ahead of me in terms of like what he's bringing out. And like at various times, it just kind of like, man, that's relatable. Or in some cases, it's not. Now, when Ashtray Rock came out, it was sort of for me, it was 2007, 2008. That's when I kind of went from being a call center worker person to being a professional teacher. It sort of landed when I was around Korea, coming back to New Brunswick, about to go to Qatar, sort of right in there. So that came out during the spring or summer or whatever. And I was like doing my 1 year B.Ed. program at St. Thomas University, just getting my teaching certificate for high schools and whatnot. Living by myself. Well, I was sharing an apartment with my dad, actually. You know, my wife was back in Korea with her family for a bit. And it just sort of landed at a certain time. And it's like, man, this is just the funnest shit in the world. This is just like the most, you know, I was listening to this. Is this shit as fun as I remember? And I threw it on just before this. And I'm like, fashionable people. It's like, you go into an awkward, you know, grade 9 thing and you feel weird. It's like, okay, he's going to do a convincing record about that. Now, I realize I just spent like, you know, a few couple minutes kind of describing the personal circumstances about it. I don't know that I would have cared about it as much if it landed at a certain time. It's sort of when I'm over at the education podcast, it's always like, you know, it's like, it's all about context. You know, it's like, contextually bound phenomena. So that's an instance of something where, like, in terms of, I don't necessarily listen to it a bunch, but I appreciate it for what it is, because it's just, you know, it tells this kind of convoluted kind of high school story about getting drunk and people in bands and falling out with each other and jealousies. And it's just like, Joel went there. He was like a 30-year-old guy having some amount of success. And he's like, I can tell this story. I can get my friends involved. We can get, you know, it sounds like they're having a hoot. It just sounds like, I'm just like, okay, positive vibes on the now. Here we go. So Ashtray Rock by Joel Plaskett of Urgency. I am unreservedly a fan. And I will pass it back over to you, Dan.
Well, I figured I would. Oh wow, we'll go since we just had Joel Plaskett. I figured I'd go for a different, I don't know if I'd say, I wouldn't say can rock icons, but definitely some big, one of the bigger Canadian bands I'd say in the past couple decades, in my opinion. And that
is
it Rush? No, it's not, but. When I was thinking concept albums, I thought, why not David Comes to Life, the third album from Toronto's Fucked Up, who, I don't know, they're Fucked Up for a band that, even though I don't always love everything I do, I appreciate their ambition. Because, like, I feel like when you hear people talk about an ambitious band these days, a lot of the time it's like, oh, they're trying to get sponsored by Taco Bell. And with Fucked Up, it's like, we're going to make a double album rock opera that's our quadrifine, you know, for our third album to follow up our Polaris Prize winning album. We're going to make a double album rock opera that's our Quadrophenia about a working class lad in Northern England, seaside town, who falls in love with a young communist activist or something and ends up like accidentally causing chaos in an explosion while trying to impress her, and, you know, told from a series of unreliable narrators, that also has an accompanying soundtrack album to the double concept rock opera album called David's Town, where the members of the band went and wrote what they thought the songs that all the characters from the double, you know, double album rock opera would have been listening to at the time. Like their versions of, you know, sort of like whatever, like popular new wave bands or like, you know, like kind of more like scruffy oi type bands for the David character. And like that sort of, like they went and wrote a bunch of, yeah. Like I said, like that's one of the things I like, even though like song for song, I might not love every song choice that Fucked Up makes. It's like, they're fucking trying things, you know? Like, even just like, I remember hearing like their first couple 7 inches back in like, you know, 2002, 2003, and thinking like, wow, these guys are pretty good. And then it's like, they just kept building on that. And like their first album, they're like, hey, we're gonna take that 3 minute song and make it a 5 minute song with a couple other kind of wacky ideas you might not have been thinking of. And then their second album is like, well, you know, we're just gonna really expand our musical palette here and have like the guy from Final Fantasy playing violin and like all these other weird guest artists. And then, you know, the third album, I know a lot of people, I remember a few people kind of falling off David Comes to Life, falling off their journey when David Comes to Life came out. Like, it was too much for them. It was almost like it was their Sandinista, you know? Like, but it's like, I appreciate good. It. And some of the, like Queen of Hearts, that was like the big lead off single for the song, or whatever. It's like, it's a pretty great song. And the music video they did for it was really cool. I watched it a couple of times. The ending right of the show where it's like set in like a one room schoolhouse where the kids are, it's like the kids are being taught the musical based on the story of David and Veronica that the rock opera is based on or whatever. And they've got like this class of like, you know, all the girls on one side singing the Veronica parts and all the guys on the other part, like singing the David parts that are like the screamy, like Damien Abraham vocals. And just kind of, yeah, it's just like, I like it. It's cool. I can get it. I appreciate the ambition. And yeah, even like when they did win when they won the Polaris Prize, I think for their second album, they turned around and took that money and spent it getting like recording like basically like the indie rock, like, you know, like the indie rock We Are the World, but it was a cover of Do They Know It's Christmas After All, but like with members of like Vampire Weekend and like David Cross and like Tegan and Sarah and all these other people, and then used the money that single made, took that and donated it to like charities around missing and murdered Indigenous women. Like, so like, yeah, it's I know their singer was a VJ for a while, and like also speaking of Vice, has done some stuff with Vice. Actually, he's done some pretty interesting stuff with Vice, and he's got his podcast Turned Out a Punk that's a pretty interesting listen if you get a chance. Like, he's talked to everybody over the years, and it's just like basically like grilling like various like figures on like what their first show was and that sort of thing. And it can be pretty entertaining. But yeah, David Comes to Life, it's like it's a lot of music. Like I said, it's a double album, which like a double album from like a punk rock band, even if it's a punk rock band that's really kind of like a really shouty shoegaze band a lot of the time, it can be a lot. But like I said, the fact that they, you know, they decided to make a fucking rock opera and like take this character that like, you know, it's like was mentioned, it was like they had a song on their first album called David Comes to Life that was kind of like almost like, you know, if you were writing the outline of what you were eventually going to try and expand into this rock opera, and just give like a quick precis of like, if you're writing the theme song of the sitcom that it was based on, that told you the story leading up to that point. That was the short song sort of giving you the basic idea. And then like, oh no, third album, rock opera. And yeah, so I figured if I'm talking concept albums, I would definitely put David Comes to Life on there. Especially concept albums by like, you know, big Canadian bands. So yeah. That.
That sounds sick and it sounds legit. I cannot say enough good things about that second record that you mentioned, Chemistry of Everyday Life or yeah. Common Life.
Chemistry of Common Life.
Yeah, that's sick. I mean, I don't give a shit about the Polaris, but like that's the context I discovered that band through. And I'm just like, wow, that album is just for me. Perfect from start to finish. I ambitious, psychedelic. I mean, those cats are wild is what they are in TO. And it's just sort of like when you were describing like the extra instrumentation and stuff, I'm like, yeah. And then they probably got like broken social scene. You know, it's like you start.
Oh yeah. It was like the broken social scenization of music.
Or you know, like you get a fiddle and suddenly you're the Arcade yeah. Fire, you know,
yeah. Like, okay. Like definitely a Feist yeah. guest feature somewhere.
Right. Well, as we're winding down, I'll probably just take my last moment here to say that there's a few records that I'm just going to refer to just fleetingly, just to say that I committed them into the recording, and I'll probably maybe have a bit more to say to them in the notes. You know, this is obviously something we could easily do another one of these, and maybe yet we shall. I'd be remiss, speaking of double albums, if I didn't speak to just in, you know, more so perhaps in the notes at this point, Zen Arcade, Husker Du, right? SST Records, one of my favorite artists, favorite, you know, significant releases. You know, SST being pretty major imprint, as we talked in the show, on music generally. And speaking of SST, speaking of double records, I would say Double Nickels on the Dime by the Minutemen also qualifies as a concept record of sorts. I mean, if you get the vinyl, each of the sides starts with Car Noises, and very regrettably, D. Boone, I mean, he was killed in a car accident, right? I mean, so not that long after that recording came out, even really, because he was a young guy, even though they had tons of records. And a couple others, just in terms of like favorites that I would call concept records. Lou Reed, New York, big one for me. I love discovering that. That's one of his like harder kind of guitar records, just straight up. I like Lou when he's doing just his straight up rock stuff a little bit more. And he did a whole friggin' album with a cohesive narrative about it to there. And the very last one that I'll plug prior to shutting my commentary down for the episode, Ben Nichols. He did, from Lucero, he did a really awesome EP, Last Pale Light in the West, wherein he adapted some characters and situations from the brilliant goddamn novel by Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian. And Ben actually studied literature and history, you know, like while Lucero was kind of getting up and going. And it just, it shows. He's got a great appreciation for that novel, and he just had a chance to do a really awesome solo, really rich, you know, six songs about it. So that is my batch of picks, winding her down.
All right.
Anything you want to throw out there, bud, as your last ones here?
Well, I've got two other picks I guess I could quickly touch on that I'll go into a little deeper on the notes that are two very different sorts of concept albums that also happen to be combination, both different combinations of things I like. The first being Handsome Boy Modeling School. So how's your girl? Which is Handsome Boy Modeling School is Prince Paul, who was the producer for the first three De La Soul albums, as well as like he was just. One of the main architects of, well, I think I might have mentioned it on the, like when I talked about De La Soul on the show way back when, but there was a point where it was like De La Soul and the Beastie Boys were kind of having their White Album versus Pet Sounds moment. And Prince Paul was one of the driving factors behind, behind the De La Soul side of things. And they actually fired him after the release of Balloon Mind State because it was, you know, the album that was just too arty and just a little too out there for them even, and not commercial, you know, not even in hopes of being commercial enough for what they had, you know, been trying to do at least. But yeah, he's just like, he's the guy that created the idea of the skit on a hip hop album. And Handsome Boy Modeling School, for better or worse. But yeah,
that's who I blame for that. Okay.
Yeah, Three Feet High and Rising by De La Soul is the first album to have the between song skit featured. With their weird, they had a little like interstitial game show bits between a bunch of the several of the songs at that. Anyways, but Handsome Boy Modeling School is Prince Paul and Dan the Automator, who is Dan the Automator is the non Damon Albarn half of Gorillaz. The non Damon Albarn or animated ape half of Gorillaz, who also has worked with he did the Dr. Octagon album with Cool Keith, and he has the band Lovage what's the name from Faith No More, Mike Patton. They have a lounge project called Lovage together. And anyways, Handsome Boy Modeling School is their tribute to the Chris Elliott sitcom Get a Life, that they use a joke from this Chris Elliott sitcom from the aughts as a way to sort of have a bit of commentary on like what they thought was sort of commercialization and just consumerist, a lot of consumerist themes in hip hop at the time, like in the aughts, and featuring like an all-star cast of sort of indie weird rap characters of the day. And it's a fun album. And my other pick that I'll quickly touch on, that's something completely different, is the original pre-stage show, pre-movie, just rock opera album of Jesus Christ Superstar, which is Andrew Lloyd Webber and like members of Deep Purple and Manfred Mann and like the UK cast of Hair and just like a bunch of like 60s psychedelic blues rock folks using the story of the last week of Jesus's life to tell us talk about the co-opting of social movements and like the corrupting influence of like fame and celebrity, all mostly told from the perspective of Judas Iscariot and with Ian Gillan from Deep Purple as Jesus. And that was the album that when Andrew Lloyd Webber wasn't able to get funding to do an actual stage show, he just got all these like British like 60s like psych rock and like blues rock musicians, and they're like, here's this fucking weird, it's like, it's not gospel music, but it does say Jesus a lot, and it's a combination of like 60s psych rock and ham-handed social commentary through genre fiction, which is something else I enjoy. Someone being a big fan of like Star Trek and Planet of the Apes and like 60s Jack Kirby comics and that sort of like that, like, we're trying to get a good message in there by genre story, and this is like, here's the tale, it's the classic like, here's the tale of another long-haired guy with some ideas that the man wanted to take down, but with this like ridiculous Batman villain of a King Herod, and it's like a psychedelic rock, psychedelic rock opera, but just happens to be about Jesus getting turned in by his friends for his head, getting a big head and turning away from their original message or whatever. That just, it's one of those things that like, I'll watch it. Like it ends up like, if I end up seeing it like on TV, I'll always sit down and watch it. Cause like I said, it's pretty the movie version that Norman Jewison did, the way that it's set up as like, here's like these scrappy hippie like theater folks that are just gonna come tell you a story in the desert about a guy that like, I don't know. It's fun. I enjoy it. It's not something I listen to all the time, but like, I remember there was like an alt comedy production of it that Julie Klausner and the How Was Your Week podcast did, I think about 10 years ago, that had like Ted Leo and AC Newman from The New Pornographers and like Jean Grey and a bunch of folks like that, like all doing a, just as put out as much as they could, given the litigious nature of some of the creators, into the world. That was pretty entertaining also. But yeah, anyways, those are my last couple picks for concept albums. I know we're kind of, we're running long here, but yeah.
That's more than fine. I am deeply surprised at that last one, and I'm not going to deny anybody the joy who would rush out to engage with that. We've covered a lot of terrain with this with this episode, and I just feel like, let's maybe every 12 to 18 months or whatever, we can revisit this one, because definitely more we can speak to.
Started with black metal and ended with Andrew Lloyd Webber. So
it's legit. And hopefully not litigious. That is it for me. It has been a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for checking it out. Anything else you want to throw out here, Dan?
No, I'll just say, see you around.
Till next time, folks.